Ford predicting the future, can your TV hack your computer, and Verizon's colossal announcement. All that and more on the Slongcast. Hello, and welcome to the Slongcast, episode 19, for Tuesday, January 11th, 2011. Ah, it's weird. I'm not going to remember 2011 every time I go to write it.
Yeah, it's always trouble when you write checks. It's like, damn it, void that one.
I always screw it up, every time. And you brought this up a little earlier before we started recording. This is the first Slongcast with snow outside.
Yes, it's been snowing. We have a lot of snow here.
It's a snowpocalypse.
It's kind of funny you mentioned that. I brought that up at work, and I was like, remember last year we had that snowpocalypse? And like everyone was like freaking out.
Yeah, literally the whole way home tonight, I was kind of sliding around everywhere. It's like the snow is laying on the roads. And
They didn't get out there to do the pre-salt.
Yeah, they definitely did not do that. It's kind of bad.
Yeah.
But if you live around where we live in western Pennsylvania, you probably know exactly what we're talking about because we're going to get pounded tonight.
Yep.
But anyway, let's get away from snow. How were your holidays? Christmas and New Year's. We haven't done a show since before the holidays.
And Thanksgiving, dude.
Wow.
Yeah.
How were all three of your holidays?
It was pretty good. I mean, well, I spent my one holiday in a foreign country, which will remain nameless. I was in a foreign country for Thanksgiving, and then I actually spent Christmas in Florida with my and this is actually maybe news. I'm engaged now.
Oh, way to go, Ryan.
Yeah.
That is news. That happened during our break.
Yes, it did. So I spent Christmas with my fiance in Florida and at the Magic Kingdom for a day, which was pretty interesting.
Nice.
And then New Year's was pretty basic, just spent it with some friends.
Yeah, my holidays were pretty low-key. Didn't really do much, didn't go anywhere. Normal Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's.
Yeah.
Not too much. It seems like it was pretty slow in the tech sector, too. I didn't really see much that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, there was a couple things here and there. Like, I tagged a few articles, but I was so busy. And
yeah, that's the thing. Around that time of year, I mean, for those of you who don't know, I took the whole month of December off from my full-time job.
So he was not busy. He was not busy.
Well, I was not busy from my full-time job, but for some reason, I was still really busy. Right. I don't understand it.
I hear it had something to do with Call of Duty.
I haven't played video games since college, with the exception of Portal, which I can't wait for Portal 2 to come out.
Well, it could have been the redecorating of the studio.
That's true. Ever since the last show, I went to Joann Fabrics and bought some nice, shiny, burgundy color pieces of fabric and ran them all around the studio, you know, to cover up the paneling. So whenever I get ready to do video for this podcast, we'll actually have a nice backdrop.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I just need some more to come out and cover you so that whenever you're on camera, the backdrop is behind you.
It's almost like you had an episode of Trading Spaces in here. I really mean it.
That's how good it is. Yes. I'm a horrible designer. Okay, so enough about my design work. Let's jump right into the stories. So first story, Goldman Sachs customers get Facebook financials. This is an article from Reuters. Apparently, Goldman Sachs decided to give out the numbers about Facebook to some of their customers, numbers that nobody has ever had anymore, such as their valuation, how much money they've earned this year, or I guess it would be last year. $355 million in the first 9 months of 2010. That's how much they brought in. Ridiculous.
That's a lot of money. I mean, like, I think Microsoft made, like, I don't know, $12 billion or something.
Yeah, and the big thing in here is...
Oh, but by the way, a billion is 1,000 times bigger than a million.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. But Facebook's valuation is $50 billion. That's a lot of money for a social networking company.
Well, I mean, it doesn't seem too far off. I mean, if you take, like Apple's valuation of like right now, like what,
yeah, but Apple 200... does stuff.
Well, right, but I mean, if you look at revenue versus their valuation, so like Apple's revenue every year is like, I don't know, I want to say like 10 billion ish.
Apple is number two.
Right
behind Exxon, I believe now.
Well, no. That's market capitalization.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, the market capitalization is that would be equivalent to, I guess, Facebook's value, and the market capitalization for Apple is like $230 or $240 billion, and their revenue per year is in like, I want to say, the 10 billion mark, or maybe like 14, something in that range. So, as a fraction of its, you know, market capitalization, which would I could assume is close to an evaluation of the company, $355 million in net income in the, which is basically revenue. Net income.
Yeah, gross income is nothing taken out. Net income.
So
is
I'd
take
say
no
this
money.
Valuation is very fair. Then very fair.
Yeah, and it's so fair, apparently, that Goldman Sachs is investing $450 million of its own money into Facebook.
Yeah.
Like, they must really think, they must know something about Facebook.
Here it is, $1.2 billion in revenue. So let's take Apple in comparison. So it's about one-tenth the revenue, and it's only about one-sixth the valuation. So I guess it maybe is a little high.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't know where their revenue is coming from. Like, is it really only coming from ads? Because that's all they do. They don't do anything as a company.
Yeah, I wonder how that works. Like, I know a little bit about financial stuff, but I don't understand if like the revenue that if they count in like capital that's invested into the company as well. Probably not. It's probably just like money made,
right,
like, or income. Not like investment.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. But either way, this, we have yet to see what happens, you know, who gets in trouble, because some of these numbers should not have been known to the public, and Goldman Sachs leaked them. So
yeah, that's not good.
Yeah, Mark Zuckerberg cannot be happy. But anyways, our next story, coming from Ars Technica, is a little bit of a squabble between Microsoft and a security researcher.
Who is from Google.
Yes. So here's the deal with this. This dude from Google, he has a fuzzing tool called CrossFuzz. And for those of you who don't know, a fuzzing tool basically is a tool that throws random amounts of input or random amounts of data to the inputs of a program to try and break it. You know, if you have a program that accepts your age, a fuzzer would throw numbers, letters, special characters, all kinds of random junk, and lots of it at that program to see what breaks it, more so than humans can do because it's automated and it's fast. So this dude had a tool like that, and he threw it at Internet Explorer, and he got it to break. He told Microsoft about it. He gave them, what was it, like 6 months?
Well, yeah, he claims that he gave them, like, he emailed them 6 months before he released the information.
Yeah, he told them he was going to go public
right
in 6 months. And he said, here's the problem. Here's my tool. Here's what I did to break it. You should be able to replicate this in 2 seconds and then figure out how to fix it. And you guys know that I'm not a fan of Microsoft, and this just seems something that they do all the time. It seems like they ignored him. And then even when they didn't ignore him, they said, oh, you gave us stuff that didn't work. We couldn't actually see that this was a problem. You know, they kind of sat on it until, what, about a month before he released it, or until the day he released it. And now Microsoft's complaining, oh, you released a zero-day bug. We didn't know about this. It's... Exactly. I had to put it in here because we have to have one bad Microsoft article. But
it's a rule. It's part of my contract.
It is in the contract. But, I mean, you would think they would learn by now. Like, why? What is their problem? Do they think people are just trying to say, hey, I found a zero day? Like, they're not paying for it. You know, Microsoft's not giving this dude any money, whether he found something or not. Why would they not treat it as a potential problem?
Well, I think they probably just get a lot of this stuff. And not just because their software is bad, you know, That's not what I'm trying to insinuate.
Well, I mean, they're out there. A lot of people use it, so...
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think the number of bugs found is going to be directly proportional to your user base, really, to be quite honest. I mean, given roughly equivalent quality control processes, you know, it's definitely going to scale with your user base. And they have a lot more users, so they're going to have a lot of people finding these things. And not only that, because it's the biggest, it becomes a target. So you even get like more researchers involved in studying it than would maybe even be normal. So they probably just get a lot of this email, and it's hard to sort through what's real and what's not.
Yeah, I wonder what their backlog is.
No clue.
You know, if they actually do keep all of these reports that they get in and go through them one by one to figure out, oh, that's not good. You know, this is a problem. That's fake. That's a guy just trying to scam us. You know, they're never going to release that information. But
it's got to be a tough job. I think it would be very tough.
I can only imagine how many people they have dedicated to going through the email of vulnerability reports and testing the stuff. I mean, that's the job. That is job security. You work for Microsoft as a vulnerability tester of vulnerabilities that people report. Like, those are never ending. You will always have a job.
Well, yeah, as long as you do it well, I guess.
Yeah, as long as you don't suck.
Or maybe not.
Ooh, because if you do suck, then the problems still exist.
Right, so and it comes back to haunt you.
Yes.
And you get paid to fix it, and you don't fix it, and it happens all over again.
Oh.
It's like Groundhog Day.
Oh, I love that movie.
Which is on its way.
That's true.
It's like 20 days away.
And for those of you who don't know, that's Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. They actually recorded it there. No, that's...
Yeah, well, actually... Well, I don't think they did, actually.
Yeah.
There's parts of it. Like that whole part with like the gobbler's knob and all that, that's not real.
But yeah.
They show it in the center of town. It's actually like out in the forest.
Yeah.
But there were
parts of it recorded in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. It's not too far from here.
Yeah, I think even one part was recorded like near Pittsburgh because like I recognized like the scenery.
Huh. I'll have to watch it again. I haven't seen it for a while.
Yeah, it's been probably 10 years. For me.
Really?
I'd say.
Oh, wow.
At least five.
I was going to say at least since last year around Groundhog Day when they ran it on TV. But anyways, keeping up with the Microsoft stories and just the fact that a lot of people use their products, if you used Hotmail recently, you might have noticed that your entire mailbox disappeared. Or what Microsoft claims, some affected accounts went back 10 years.
Wow.
So apparently Microsoft had a bug that affected nearly 20,000 accounts during the Christmas holiday. All of their email messages disappeared. Do you use Hotmail?
No.
I don't either. This is why.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I just had to bring this up just so, you know, people were aware of it. If it did affect you, you probably really noticed and got really scared. But... Microsoft did fix it, and by the end of the 2nd of January, everything was restored. Oh, this is rough.
I don't know. Mistakes happen, though. That's why there's backups.
Mistakes do happen, but the one thing that gets to me is that, you know, whenever you use these online services that are free, like Gmail, Hotmail, Yahoo for your email, you run the risk of losing stuff because they don't promise you anything. You're not paying for anything. If something bad happens and all of your stuff goes away, they're not required to restore it. You know, these guys got lucky that Microsoft had backups of everything to restore their email. They could have said, hey, you're not paying for this. Screw you.
Yeah, but I think I understand the mentality there in the sense that, you know, you're leaving it up to them to figure out. But I kind of equate it to like a false sense of security. And managing it yourself because I think this like maybe draws some parallels to like travel by airlines and travel by car. Like cars seem safer because you're in control and like, you know, oh, I drive the car, so I know where it's going to go. And as long as I pay attention, it's safe. But if you look at the real statistics out there, like airline travel is like two orders of magnitude, if not more, safer than cars.
Right.
So like, I would like to see the number of people that have lost all of their mail that are like still downloading it via like SMTP or IMAP or something and managing it in their own backup system versus the number of people that have lost all their mail on some, you know, service that they use online. I I agree that there's that risk, but the risk sort of exists for everyone. And I think if they lost one person's, they'd probably lose a lot of people's at the same time.
Right.
And there would be some more public outcry over it. And you might actually have some like a better like leveraging position to make sure that they do replace it.
Yeah, really, I mean, the only reason I can think of that they would lose just a single person's mailbox is if somebody hacked that person's mailbox and deleted stuff. You know, because normally, if they lose one, that means a server died or hard drives died, and in that case, thousands would be affected.
Right. So, and yeah. I'd expect that most of these places have pretty good backup, or at least, like, what do they, like, failover or some sort of
clustering or something that something takes over for another one.
Right.
But it's all fixed, so even if you do have Hotmail, you don't have to worry because everything's back to normal as of a week and a half ago. So moving on, our next story is something that I have wanted Adobe to do for a long time. I don't know why they never did it before. But with their new Reader X, which I'm assuming stands for Adobe Reader 10, I'm pretty sure the X is a Roman numeral for 10, they're making it sandboxed. Which is amazing, because we keep seeing in the vulnerability news about people attacking PDFs, specifically Adobe Reader, and gaining control of the system through them. And now that is going to be a lot harder to do, because they're making their reader in a sandbox environment, so even if you do happen to take complete control of Adobe Reader, you can't get out into the system. So what do you think of this whole sandboxing technique for Adobe?
Well, I mean, obviously, if it enhances their security, I think it's a good idea. Although I will say, like, Reader is already a pretty bloated product.
I was just going to ask, would this sandboxing technology make you go back to using Adobe Reader in lieu of Foxit or some other slimmer reader?
Well, I switched to Foxit probably, let's see, at least 4 years ago, if not longer. And at that time, Foxit was still too immature, in my opinion. So I switched back to Reader. And I haven't left since. But that said, I mean, I have a lot of PDFs, but most of my PDFs come from very well-known sources. Like, they're manuals and stuff like that. They're not like, oh, I don't know, some weird PDF. But I don't even know, like, where you would get a weird PDF with a virus.
A lot of the vulnerabilities in PDF came from, JavaScript embedded or PDFs that attempted to contact the internet through links or something. And it might have been a good PDF, but somehow a website that the PDF pointed to got compromised and the code came back in.
Right.
So,
well, that said, I think it's a good idea. I mean, I haven't left Reader in a long time. I'll probably, upgrade. You know, wait. They say this is Reader X, but didn't Reader 10 already exist?
That's why I'm wondering if this actually means 10. I mean, it seems like from the article they're talking about, Reader 8 upgrading to Reader 9 or Reader 9 upgrading to Reader X.
Okay.
I'm guessing that this has to be Reader 10.
I've never seen it called that way, but whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. I agree with you. A couple years ago, Foxit was pretty immature, and it didn't support things like filling out PDFs that had fillable forms, form fields, and things like that. But nowadays, it is great, and there are even options, which I'm sure Adobe has too, to disable JavaScript, to disable links hitting the internet. So basically, you just have a PDF that does nothing. And that's kind of how I set it up on my own reader. So if I happen to need all those features, I can turn them on. But by default, I'm never going to get taken advantage of from a PDF because I just disabled everything. But yeah, I agree. Bloatware, Adobe Reader takes 3 hours to load anytime you want to view a PDF.
I guess the point is that this just might make it worse.
That is true. Sandboxing might make things take a lot longer to load. Well, we have yet to see.
Why don't we just go back to text documents?
Seriously, what was wrong with text documents?
In ASCII art, like, I love that. Have you ever like checked out some of like the forums for like Google Code? People like do ASCII art in the code or in the.
I've never seen that, but yeah. I do go searching for ASCII art every once in a while, like facepalm and.
Yeah, it's funny stuff.
Love ASCII art. Love text. Text is the way to go.
Yes.
So moving on, we always talk about net neutrality. There's almost at least one article in every Songcast that we do.
But not today.
Oh, wait. We have an article that it just so happens Google and Verizon were again trying to implement some things that were against net neutrality, and the FCC laid the smackdown. So, I don't know. I mean, like the guy said in the article, you can't fault them for trying to do things that will make them more money. Basically, they were trying to push the tiered internet again. Google and Verizon both were trying to push, you know, different tiers, access to different things, slowing down, you know, that some services should be distinguishable from traditional broadband internet access services. And the FCC chairman kind of came in and said, you know, no, we're not going to let you do this. You know, as long as they have control, they're not going to let you do this. So I don't know if you've heard anything in the past month about net neutrality, any changes, anything going on.
Well, I know that you know, sort of like the FCC's take on net neutrality was released sometime between now and the last Slongcast we did.
Yeah, it was.
And I read through it in some summaries of it, and I also read this article about this FCC member that condemned the view of Google and Verizon. But what the article said, what he had a problem with, didn't seem to be all that different from the FCC's decision, if I remember correctly, because they one of the main things they did was segment wired and wireless,
right,
and sort of give wireless a special, like, okay, you can violate net neutrality in the wireless world because the bandwidth just isn't there yet. And I thought that's kind of what this guy was saying he had a problem with in terms of what Google and Verizon said. So, like, I don't know. I'm trying to, like, maybe I read it wrong, and maybe I need to go back and read the FCC's stuff again, but it seemed to me that maybe he just, like, was siding – this guy is, like, siding with the net neutrality folks and saying that, you know, I don't agree with it, but it's not necessarily against that new plan. I don't know.
Yeah, and this is actually something that I believe T-Mobile is going to start enforcing. – They sent out emails to all of their people who use a lot of data. Now, I'm not quite sure it's T-Mobile, but I think it was. That this whole thing that, you know, if you want to stream video and you want to do all this data-heavy stuff, save it for home. You're not supposed to do that on your phone. So now they are basically violating net neutrality in what they're doing, that you're never going to get cut off. But if you go over their caps that they have, they're now cutting you back to just browsing the internet. You will no longer be able to stream movies for that month or download large files for that month. You could only just browse the internet. So, I don't know. That kind of meets halfway. They're not cutting off your connection. They're not making you pay more.
Well, if there's truly a cap and you violate the cap, you're lucky to even have access at all.
Yeah.
I read something, I don't know if it was T-Mobile or not. I thought it was T-Mobile, that they said they were going to, if you went over, like, they had like a 1 gigabyte cap, I think, on something. And they said if you hit 500 megabytes, then the other 500 megabytes, you'd have to do it on Wi-Fi. Like, only,
wow.
Yeah, like on their 3G network, the first 500 gigabytes you could use, but then the other 500 gigabytes you had to use for, if you were using video, like streaming technologies.
Right.
That you'd have to do it on one of their Wi-Fi hotspots, not the 3G network.
That would why not just make the cap 500 megs?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's really weird.
Or maybe it was like 1 gig versus 2 gig, but it was like half of the normal cap.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to see a lot more data usage changes happening. We'll get to the article that I'm referring to at the end of the show, but I'm sure it's going to be coming in the next couple months, all the companies changing their data usage plans.
Well, like, what I'm kind of still interested in is, like, are they really losing money on these services, or are they just looking at it on a user-by-user basis and, like, on some users they're losing money in the sense if they gave them their fair fraction of, like, their total revenue, that on those specific users, they're so heavily using the network that they're losing out. And if that's the case, that tells me that they're not properly pricing the service.
Right.
But if they did properly price it, their demand would go way down, and they wouldn't be able to provide the service at that price either. So I think they're, you know, the people that, you know, are sort of like the bandwidth hogs, we're just going to kind of have to live with them, because if we really want to pay what the service actually offers, or unless we're okay with tiered internet, and even that, I just don't think it'll be feasible. Like,
yeah, and even this is a point that I believe you brought up in a previous show that, I just lost it. I had a brain fart.
About tiered internet?
No, I was going to say that, you know, paying per bit, you know, like a water, you know, pay for your water bill. You know, if we did that, your point was that if things were priced the way they should be, nobody would buy it because it would just be way too expensive.
Right.
You know, so
and then the
we
demand
started
goes
off,
down, and then it gets even more expensive.
Yeah, we started off with our phone plans at such a low level that we're used to it, that if we see it go up to where it should be, everybody's going to be mad.
Right. And then I just think it's like a vicious circle. Like the prices will go up even higher because there's less demand, and they need to recoup the cost, and then it'll just fall apart. So
yeah, who knows?
It's sort of like the way internet's priced is almost like group health insurance. Like everybody pays the same in a particular group,
and only a few people use it.
Right, and I just have to live with it because it's like, well, in an emergency, I might need it.
Right. In the one case that you do need it, you're lucky you pay for it.
Right.
Keeping in line with mobile phones, I thought this was really cool, and I'm interested to see how the topic of this next article turns out. It's an article from Wired. The FCC says they are updating 911 for the texting generation. And what they mean by that is that if you need to call 911... you might be able in the future to send them a picture message to show the emergency authorities what you're seeing.
Like, so instead of saying, quick, there's a man trying to murder me,
you can show them a picture of a dude with a gun to your head.
Right. Or like a guy coming at you with a knife.
I mean, I actually had this idea before this article came out, and I thought of contacting our local, you know, emergency services and being like, hey, you guys should really look into implementing this. Because I just thought, I had saw a lot of, you know, fires happening on the news. And I'm like, if I saw this or downed telephone lines whenever we had those high winds around here a couple months ago, and I thought, you know, I can call into Penelec and say, hey, my power's out. They don't know anything more than that other than my power's out. They got to go looking around trying to figure out what the problem is. But if I see a downed line, I would love to take a picture, send it to Penelec and say, hey, here's the problem. Come right here and you can fix it.
Yeah.
You know, that would be pretty cool.
That is cool.
And apparently, the FCC is doing something similar to that for 911 services. Do you think you would ever use that?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends. Like, I could see this being useful. Like, they mention an example in the article about the students at the Virginia Tech massacre in 2008 or 2009. And the fact that they... you know, they listed, they tried to text 911, but were unsuccessful in doing so.
Right.
So I think if there was a situation where, like, calling on a phone wouldn't work because you would give up your location to the attacker, then this would become really handy.
Yeah. I think it's a good idea. Before I move on to I'll actually start introducing the next story, and I'll let Ryan run upstairs to grab the tissue box. I notice you have a cold.
Oh, yeah, I do. I do.
It's right up around to the left.
Okay.
So Ryan's going to take a short break and run and grab the tissue box. I don't want him to be in pain for the whole show. But I'll move on to introducing the next article that we're going to be talking about. So for those of you who haven't kept up with Ford and what they've been doing in their newer vehicles, Ford Sync is pretty cool. I mean, I'm sure you've seen it. In the commercials, you press the button on the steering wheel and you can voice control your car or certain functions of your car, such as the radio or your phone if your phone is Bluetooth connected, your MP3 player, you know, whatever the case may be. Well, now Ford has actually been updating Sync with the, they call it Traffic Directions and Information Capable, TDI. And Ford Sync is now, combined with the app on your iPhone, telling you when the best time is to leave. So you'll basically, you know, open up the app, tell it where you want to go. It'll figure out where you're at currently, and it will look at the traffic patterns from the I don't want to say borough information, but wherever the traffic information comes from for your area, and they will give you an approximate time of when you should leave to arrive at your specified time. So, yeah, you could always just leave an hour early and show up and, you know, have a half hour to waste. But this will tell you if you leave 5 minutes after you thought you should have, you're probably going to be a half hour late because we're predicting rush hour is going to start. So I think this is really cool. I wish all cars would implement this, you know, kind of predicting when the best time is to leave.
Yeah, I don't know why this has to be exclusive to Sync, though. Like, couldn't just any old app that tapped into, like, traffic information tell you this based on your location and destination?
I would imagine it could.
Yeah.
It seems like Ford has just been the first person to implement something like this.
Yeah. I don't see why this would have to be. I mean, it's cool that Sync does it, and I guess maybe it's free as part of your, like, Sync subscription, but, I mean, I don't see why this wouldn't work. Because, you know, Google has all that traffic data that they somehow display on their maps for different municipalities.
Right. And if you look at the screenshots in this article from Motor Authority, you see that they are using Google Maps with the Google Map traffic data.
Oh, okay. So, I always thought that Google Maps got it from all the people using Google Maps on their phone.
I don't know how that works.
And they, like, tracked, like, how fast the Google Maps application reported a speed based on location or something.
I wonder how that would work because, you know, what would it be tracking me right now? I've been in the same place for, you know, a half an hour. Does it think Johnstown traffic is, you know,
stop,
dirt slow?
Well, it could be that it has to be like, it has to move and then stop and then move and then
right.
stop.
Yeah, I don't know how that works.
I mean, they could definitely design some kind of hysteresis. Or, like, or they just geolocate it to the only on the highway. Like, I mean, the GPS, if you're using actual GPS, it should be good enough to locate it within, like, a couple meters. I guess if you're, like, have a house that's, like, right on a major highway, though, that would, like, really F with them.
Yeah. That is true.
But again, like, I mean, with, you know, with statistical analysis, you can throw out the outliers and put in a hysteresis and say it has
right.
to move for so long and then stop for so long. And
yeah, I definitely think this is cool, though. I can't wait until all cars do this because it would be so nice just to pop up my iPhone and say, I'm going to Pittsburgh. When I want to be there for the show that starts at 7:30, when should I leave? And have it tell me, here's the best time based on traffic.
10 a.m.
Right? You missed it. You're going to be late.
Better leave now.
I wonder what it would say if, like, it's 6 o'clock, you say you want to be in Pittsburgh by 7, if it just pops up and says, just stay home.
Like, put the metal to the pedal to the metal.
Put the metal to the pedal.
Yep. Yeah, as in, like, a lead foot.
Exactly.
That's what I meant.
So this next article, I believe, is one that you submitted about a Windows Home Server.
Oh, yeah. Microsoft is getting set to launch their new version of Windows Home Server. And I don't know how many all of you are familiar with that, but Windows Home Server is a pretty nice little product that really is underrated for Microsoft. It's kind of similar to, in the Apple world, the whole time capsule thing in a way, but it does more than that. It can serve up media. It can serve up, it actually can provide, like, little application extenders that do certain things, and all kinds of neat little applications can run on it. But, and it does support, like, backup, like the time capsule. But
so is it literally like the Windows Server OS?
It's actually, it's a stripped down version of Windows Server 2003.
That's cool.
And it has another, like, application that runs on top of it in, like, a shell mode type thing that provides a bunch of services to the PCs that are connected to it. It's tightly integrated. And when you actually, like, log into the machine, typically it's a headless machine, but if you do log into it, it doesn't say Windows Server 2003. It says Windows Home Server. So it does take over the machine to some extent.
Okay.
But a lot of the Windows Server 2003 features are still there. Anyway, one of the really cool features that it had is a technology called Drive Extender. And Drive Extender is probably one of the most innovative and easy-to-use drive pooling features of any OS I've ever used. And I think most of the community would agree, and that's why there's so much outcry against the fact that the new version, which has been codenamed Vail, is going to remove Drive Extender.
That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal in the Windows Home Server community. There's, I think there's a couple forums. One's like, I think we got served, maybe. I think that's like a Windows Home Server forum. And there's a couple other forums, but there's a lot of like outcry in the home theater PC crowd and home server crowd about this, about them dropping this feature. And what it does basically is it allows you to take any number of drives of any size, really, and add them to a drive pool on your Windows Home Server. And it does this seamlessly behind the scenes, unbeknownst to the user. It expands your drive pool by whatever the size of the drive is. And then you can actually specifically allocate folders or files to be sort of duplicated. And it'll the whole system manages what drives the files get put on. So if you say, I want this file to have two copies, so if a drive goes down, I make sure I have that file. You could do that for all files. Of course, your storage space would be cut in half. And it also handles other things too, like well, basically just the, you know, this, the replication and distribution of that, and like access to, you know, it makes it into one big JBOD, which is like short for just a bunch of disks.
JBOD.
So it's really cool. It's seamless. It makes RAID, like software RAID, I'll call it, accessible to even the lowliest of users that have no like real tech savvy.
Right.
It's a really, really cool feature, and they are removing it, and it's really pissing people off. And I guess part of the thought is that this drive extender technology, from the, what I know about it, is somewhat, you know, useful. And they're trying to market it to the small business community, and I think it's going to be in the small business version of the Nexus
server. So they
want
to make people pay more for it.
Yeah, so I think there's going to be like another edition of Windows Home Server that's like a little bit bigger, that's meant for like small offices.
That makes sense.
But it's not going to be a thing where like, oh, if you pay more money, you get this feature. You're going to probably lose other Windows Home Server features. Like, they're different products.
Right, because Small Business Server is not going to have Media Extender or whatever that connector is called to serve up media files and other things that home users would use.
Exactly. And, you know, we don't, no one really knows the extent of this. And I'm sure there's probably some more experts out there, but I am not one of them. But I guess in response to this, somebody sent Steve Ballmer an email about it, and they got a reply, and he said he was going to look into it. So there's maybe some hope that this decision may change. But by and large, the two most popular features of Windows Home Server were the drive extender and the ability to do these automated backups of all the Windows machines you have connected to that server, which I can speak myself. I use it at home and I love it. I just don't even think about my laptop anymore. Like, I don't care. Like, if I dropped it and broke it, like, I'd be sad. I'd be out the money for the laptop, but I know my data is safe at home.
Right.
It's just a really nice feature. And the drive extender, the other cool thing about drive extender is if you're, let's say the whole system like takes a crap on you and like stuff does not work, you can access the disks separately on another computer. And there's a very, very logical file structure on the disk. So you can get your files off them. It's not some like proprietary, you know, other than it being NTFS.
Right.
It's not some crazy weird format where like files are like separated across disks.
Yeah, that was actually one of my worries, because it seems like the way you've described it, that it's using you know, Windows Dynamic Disks behind the scenes. That's how it can do this stuff on the fly. Uh-huh. And if anybody used that in like Windows 2000 previous versions, you know that it sucked.
Right.
And it always broke.
I don't know that it's not based on that. It may be based.
Oh, I'm sure it's based on it, but at least it's revamped.
Yeah, it's really, really foolproof from what I mean. And they have some nice white papers describing how it works. And, you know, oh, if you were to lose a drive or a whole system, like, here's how you get back the data. Like, they give you the file structures. Like, it'll be underneath, like, you know, there'll be a folder called, like, DE for like drive extender, and then underneath that, like, all the files that would have been replicated amongst other
right.
drives. And it's very, very logical, and I'm really, really sad to see that they've removed it.
I'm wondering, just like people have done with the old version of Windows Media Player, if they will find some way to grab a hold of the code and port it and make it so you can just download the open source version and install it.
Right. Well, part of Microsoft's answer, besides Steve Ballmer's answer saying that he's going to look into it, is that, you know, nothing would stop anyone from developing a piece of software that could be installed on a home server to provide this functionality, which is true. You know, they are Windows. They're not, you know, we like to ding them when they provide a feature that competes with people that are making money in that area. You know, like, for instance, the browser area, like back in the day when browsers weren't included. And then we also like to ding them when they take a feature away. And I think we have to be fair about it. You know, they found a market for it, possibly. But a lot of, I guess there's been a lot of talk about using Adrobo.
I have one of those. I was just going to say, I bet they saw Adrobo doing something almost exactly like that. And they're like, wait a second. People were paying $1,000 for Adrobo filled with drives, right, and we're giving this away for free with our product.
Yeah. So I guess some guys have like successfully used Drobos in their Windows home server setups or something to like sort of provide this similar drive extender functionality. But something interesting I'd like to just talk a little about, I'm not exactly sure how Drobo works and how its drive extender equivalent technology works. But if it's using RAID, there are some interesting problems with RAID. Now, does it use RAID?
No, it uses their own proprietary RAID-like,
like software-based solution.
It's within the device.
Okay.
But it's not exactly like it mimics RAID 5 in that you put in any drives of any size, whatever, pop them out, whatever, and you get redundancy. So it's not like RAID 0 where you pop a drive and you die. You know, you can still pop a drive. So it's like RAID 5, but it's Drobo's own proprietary form of RAID.
Okay.
Because you don't need all the same size disks.
Right. Well, the thing about, I don't know if I can speak much to how Drobo does it, but one of the things that Microsoft has also said is that they're going to rely on the third party vendors that sell home servers. I mean, because Microsoft just makes the OS, of course. They have like official Windows home server boxes you can buy from them, but they're typically made by HP or other companies. And they're saying, oh, these companies can just provide you a RAID. You know, they're going to integrate RAID into the system, and then that's how you'll get your drive extender. There's a couple problems with that. First off, it's not nearly as flexible, because if a drive does go down in a RAID array where stuff is spanned, you have no guarantee that the file isn't spanned across two disks. So if either disk goes down, you lose the file.
Well, that's not really the case. I mean, if you have RAID 5 and a drive dies, you're guaranteed your file is there.
RAID 5 you do, yes. But how many people are going to buy enough drives to do the RAID 5? They're probably going to do a mirror
that
or
is
a stripe.
True. Most people who do RAID do 0.
Right.
Because they say, oh, I can have so much space.
Right.
And if that's the case, it's not even RAID. It's JBOD.
Right. Well, right. It's basically JBOD. But the worst part is if it stripes it across the disk, two disks, then you have double the chance of failure of the file. So that's one bad part. The second bad part is, even with RAID 5, there's not a guarantee that you'll get the file back. And here's why. If you've started to look at or ever compared the specs on server class SCSI hard drives, or fiber channel drives versus IDE drives, you'll probably notice that the one place other than speed that they don't match up is in the error rate, and specifically the hard error rate. The hard error rate is a number that defines the occurrence of an error that is unrecoverable from the disk, meaning that it wouldn't have even detected that it happened. This could happen on write. This could happen on read. If it happens on write, it's even worse, because you can't recover the data. There's nothing you can do because it was written incorrectly.
Right.
But either way, these hard errors are unrecoverable. It doesn't know it happened, so it can't correct the error. Well, these error rates have not gone down as disks have gotten bigger.
They've actually gone up.
Yeah. It's interesting, because they used to track well with disk size, and now they don't. You know, we've seen at least one magnitude greater in disk size probably in the last couple, 3 years or so, like something like that. And the error rates are roughly the same. They're somewhere in like 10 to the negative 15th, I want to say, bits or one, wait, something like that. Maybe it's percentage. I can have to go look the numbers up. But it used to be that like some of the SCSI drives were a whole thousand or million fold better in terms of like, you know, this error rate. So if you use them in a RAID array, that you were certainly not likely to hit this error very often.
Right.
And the problem with a RAID is, when you have to rebuild the drive, several times the amount of data that the drive holds is actually transferred on the drive while it's rebuilding the array. So if you have like a 1 gigabyte drive, or let's say 1 terabyte drive, it might have to transfer several terabytes between all the disks to get everything back to normal. And that's why you may hit this error rate before you expect it. Because when you do a hardware raid, it has to rebuild the whole disk. It doesn't just rebuild the portion that has data on it. It rebuilds all of it. Now, that may be just a problem with the RAID implementation out there, but it's one nonetheless and something that's probably not likely to change until there's a new type of RAID.
Right, and it's a big problem with consumer devices.
Yes.
Because they're cheaply made.
Right, and there's a lot of drives that are being sold as like serial attached SCSI now, and those drives are one of the varieties that tend to not be server class in that sense. And even if they, even besides that, it's a problem for enterprise that's been like sneaking in under the rug. I think it's more of a problem for the consumer if they rely on this technology that may not provide the results they really want when an emergency happens.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So let me just get in two plugs here. One you already mentioned with Drobo. Now, nobody sponsors this show. I don't get money from anybody to do anything. I lose money all the time doing the stuff that I.
Yeah, he's
like
got
to
pay me, and I'm not cheap.
But Drobo is awesome. I recommend that to everybody. I have one. I use it connected to my Linux server. So even though they tell you it's not really supported by Linux, it works. It works on anything, and it works in very much the same way that Ryan just described the drive extender for Windows Home Server. You don't need to worry about having the exact same hard drives. You just pop in whatever it puts them together and shows you have a big 2 terabyte hard drive or whatever you put in. So they are kind of expensive, but definitely worth it for me.
Yeah.
You know, it was nice. And the other thing I wanted to point out is with the hard error rates. Normally, like you said, you know, those are problems. Your hard drive doesn't detect them. You can't correct them. And, you know, if you have enough of them, your system might not even boot.
Right.
There's a program written by Steve Gibson called SpinWrite. SpinWrite is pretty much the only program out there that will fix them, will go through and attempt a gajillion times to read those bad sectors, figure out what was there, put your data back, mark them as bad so your hard drive will skip over them and not die when it comes to them. So if you are one of the people who think that this is a problem, and let me just tell you, if you have a consumer class hard drive, this is a problem for you. It's a problem for everybody, whether you know it or not. You might just not have reached the limit where stuff stops working yet. But I can guarantee everybody's hard drive has these errors. And the longer you have the hard drive, the more you're going to get. But if you think that's a problem, go buy SpinWrite. And that will get your computer at least up to a working state where you can get your data off and put your data onto a new hard drive.
Yep.
So just my two plugs, Drobo and SpinWrite, both good tools to at least check out. So moving right along, this is something that takes us Linux folk back to 1998, but for Mac users, it is awesome, and that is Apple released the Mac App Store. Very similar to the iTunes App Store that iPhone users have, and the Android App Store, and any other App Store you have for mobile phones. But now there is a place for Macs to get software for their MacBook or, you know, Mac Pro desktop, whatever. And it's kind of one-click installs. You go to the store, you click, I want this product, and bam, you have it. No CDs necessary, no questions during an install. It's one-click install for everything in the store. And I say it takes us back to 1998 because, you know, most versions of Linux have had this in forms of up-to-date, yum, apt. Depending on which version of Linux you have, you've had a one-click install for all of your applications. But what do you think? Do you think it's too little, too late? Do you like the idea?
It's kind of strange. Like I find myself needing less and less software on my computer as time goes on because more and more of what I do is on the web. And I just have always looked at the web as like a big app store.
That's very true.
Least it's that way for Windows. Because there's just so much out there. You know, like, you could almost... I don't know if you guys remember the website Two Cows.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you go to Two Cows and you could get...
Anything.
Anything. You know, a lot of shareware, freeware
right.
type stuff or trialware. But you could find an app and, you know, install it, check it out. I mean, there's stuff I bought off of there. I'm trying to think, like, you know, a WinZip, wasn't that a two cows thing? It started out WinZip.
Oh, I don't know.
I think WinZip was a two cow.
So long ago.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day when, you know, all you had, all, your only choice was PKZip, WinZip became pretty popular. So, you know, I think we've had this, and it's just, it hasn't been called that.
Yeah, what I like specifically is just the no questions asked installs. You know, I hate, you know, even with, you know, downloading stuff from two cows, still had to open it up, click next, accept the agreement, tell it what folder, choose your options if you choose an advanced install, hit next three more times, and then it finally installs. You know, even to this day on applications, whether it's Windows, Mac, or Linux, I still hate that.
Yeah.
You know, this will just be nice because you click it, it's there.
Right.
So
Kevin's getting a little choked up here, reminiscing about the old Linux days.
Way back in the day. I need to drink more water.
I think this is another example of Apple copying an idea and you know, making it better. It's probably going to be better, but you know, you got to buy a $2,000 MacBook to use it. Right. So
they come late to the game with something. It is better, but they announce it as the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah,
like they did with cut and paste on the iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, I wish more Windows applications were available. Like, you know, like things like, well, they are now, but for the longest time, it's like, if I want to buy a new version of Windows, why do I have to go to a store? Like, why can't I just download it from their website?
Right.
You know, give me a torrent link for the ISO of it. And, you know, I buy it and you send me the key in my email and I, you know, I pay for it and everything. It's like, what's wrong with that?
Yeah. And the cool thing about this, if you think of it in terms of like Microsoft Office, you know, if you buy Office, you have to buy Office. Whereas with a Mac's version, you know, with iLife and iWork, they're offering all of those apps individually. So if you wanted to get Numbers, all you wanted to do was like Excel spreadsheet stuff, $20, you got Numbers. You know, so
well, you can buy the Windows or Office app separately.
Can you?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, you could always buy Word and Excel separately. Only certain ones. Like some of them, like I don't know if they sold like Publisher by itself or something. Yeah. You know, the ones that they were kind of like bundled in. But yeah. Like I think for the longest time, Access, Excel, Word, and PowerPoint have always been available. They're not cheap. I mean, they're still like $150.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah, I never realized that.
Yeah.
Okay, so forget I just said that because it doesn't mean anything. But I'm interested to see where this goes because I upgraded my Mac. You needed to download OS X 10.6.6, I believe, and that contains the App Store. So I upgraded. I got the App Store. There's really nothing in it right now that I need, so I didn't even download anything to test it out. But what I'm waiting for is when everything goes in the App Store, like Final Cut.
Yeah.
Whenever you have a 10-gigabyte install from the App Store to see how that works. So that hasn't happened yet, but we'll see what happens. So our next and a last article in this section of the show is something that I've been worried about for a long time, stealing your car wirelessly. So I always mention, you know, I don't want my car to be connected to the internet in such a way that somebody can hack it and steal it, or somebody can hack it and shut off my brakes. Well, some people have done just that. You know, we had an article in the last show or a couple shows ago where people were able to hack in and cut the brakes on a Jaguar. And now people have been able to mimic those wireless keys. If you know that some newer cars have those keys where once you get within like 10 feet or so, your car unlocks. People have been able to mimic what those wireless keys do, and they can walk up to any car with this system and get in and drive away. So this is awesome. Another case of, you know, technology to make our life easier, but also makes it easier for the bad guys.
Yeah, I think, though, it says there that they have to have access to the actual key fob, right? Like, they had to be within, like, 8 meters of the key fob.
It was something that they had to be around it to copy the signal,
right.
And then they could get within the car.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're hanging around a parking lot, not that hard to do. There's lots of people going to and from their cars, just walk near them and steal their signal.
Yeah, if you have a trained group of guys that can, like, you know, surveillance or, you know, run a surveillance pattern on cars coming into the parking lot, see who gets out of them, follow them in.
Right.
You know, when they come out and they go to unlock their car or when they lock their car or whatever, you know, catch that signal.
Well, it might not even be that hard because the key is always displaying that signal when it's within realm of the car. Like it's a low power, low voltage signal that just goes, emanates from the car to the key.
These are the ones that like unlock when you get near it.
Yeah. They're pressing it or not, that signal is always going until they get out of range.
Well, is it more of like an RFID thing where like the car interrogates the key and the key responds?
They didn't say specifically what it was. I don't know why.
Because I think that having a low-powered signal all the time would eventually drain a battery, regardless of how low-powered it is. Like, it just eventually would drain it.
Right.
And probably, you know, I would think in, like, months, not, like, years, you know?
Right.
So it would probably... I'm guessing it's an RFID thing where it sends out... The car sends out an RF signal... There's an RFID, like an interrogating or responder thing in the key that then sends back a response once it's interrogated.
Yeah, the article...
But they could relay the signal from the car to the guy that's near you 100 meters away through right. some other means, interrogate your key, and then capture it that way.
Right, and they said that, you know, depending on how rich you are, you can have the equipment that you need to, you know, walk near somebody to get the signal, or you can spend $1,000 and get the equipment that you could do it from 100 meters away.
Yeah.
And, and they said it doesn't matter. The encryption, any cryptography, any protocols, doesn't matter because it just copies the signal and pretends that it's your key.
Huh.
So nothing is safe if you have a car that does this. So I don't know what to think of it. I mean, I've never seen it done. You know, it's proof of concept. We've never... heard in the news of anybody's car getting stolen because of this, but in the future might happen.
It seems in the interrogation case, the way to make it more secure is whatever the key responds with has to be some kind of like, you know, rolling algorithm or something so that it's never the same.
Right. Yeah.
That's pretty tough.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm worried because, you know, my car is coming up on 6 years old. So in the next 5 or so years, I'm probably going to want to get a new car, and all cars at that time are going to have, you know, OnStar and wireless keys and all this technology, and I'm going to be driving something that just begs to be stolen.
Huh.
You know, it's not what I want. So let's take a little break and hear from one of our sponsors. This episode of the Slongcast is brought to you by the Nintendo Virtual Boy. Yeah, you forgot about that, didn't you? Dive into the world of 3D entertainment. Be wowed by the exceptional display that shows every game in the best color ever, red. That's right, forget blue, green, and George Takei yellow. Nintendo knows you only care about one color. Choose from the vast library of over 13 games. Be sure to check out the system that Time Magazine listed as one of the worst inventions ever. The Nintendo Virtual Boy, coming to a dusty basement near you. So have you had a Virtual Boy, Ryan?
Actually, I tried one out in a Toys R Us it was a while ago. I can't remember how long. It's been a while.
Yes. I never had one, but my cousin had one. She doesn't remember that she had one, but I remember playing it at her house. But not the best video game system ever.
No, it was pretty lame.
I'm going to say very lame.
Yeah.
I told a coworker that I was going to do this as the joke sponsor today, and he's like, is that a real thing? He never even heard of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, Virtual Boy. One of Nintendo's only huge flops.
Yeah, really. I mean, they've been pretty successful, except for Virtual Boy, and I guess the GameCube wasn't...
Yeah, the GameCube wasn't that good.
It wasn't huge, but it was still really well executed. I think it was a great system.
Yeah, it was their first foray into CDs as the medium.
Yeah, that's right. Used like those small ones.
Yeah.
I actually have one at home.
Yeah, you use what do they call them, half size or whatever?
Yeah, like three...
Pocket CDs.
3.5 inch or something.
Ooh, floppy disks.
Yeah.
So let's move on into some audio-visual style articles. And these both are also security related. Our first article comes from Security Week. Researchers hack internet-enabled TVs and discover multiple security vulnerabilities. So, great. People can now hack my home network through my TV. Do you have an internet-enabled TV at home?
I don't.
I do not either, and I don't plan on getting one.
Technically, I don't. I have a home theater PC.
Well, okay, but your TV doesn't have like apps built in or an Ethernet port on the back.
No, I have like the bare bones Vizio. It's got like, it has like detachable speakers. I think that was like the one feature.
So when you go to upgrade your TV, would you look for a TV that connects to the internet that has a Netflix app, has all of these apps and everything?
Probably not, simply because I have the home theater PC.
Right.
And it has like, I run a, you know, like a DVR software on it that has like a link into Hulu and a link into YouTube and stuff. So I really don't care for it that much. I wish it did have Netflix integration, but it seems like you can get that from a Blu-ray player nowadays.
Right. Yeah. Most have those.
But those are very similar in the sense of an internet enabled appliance. Like, you know, they could hack those too, I guess, if they can hack a TV.
Yeah. My problem with the TV is that, you know, just not so much the hacking part, but with the apps and everything, it's kind of like, you know, if something better comes out a year from now, you have to upgrade your whole TV. Like, you have to throw away a perfectly good TV to buy a new one, whereas if you just had a TV like we have right now, which is basically a monitor, all you need to do is replace your box or install a new app on your home theater server or something. Like, I really just don't see the point in these internet-connected TVs.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the direction things were going. It seemed like TVs were just turning into big monitors.
Right.
And it seems like they've reversed that course with the integration of this, with, you know, like Google TV and stuff and Netflix. And I agree with what you're saying. Because, like, one of the things that used to bother me about TV is, like, you had this TV and it had, like, all these nice features, like picture-in-picture and just lots of different things, you know, built into the TV. And you ended up hooking it to a cable box, which, like, basically negated all those features.
Right.
And we were finally just getting to the point where all those features were built into the cable boxes or the DVRs or the, you know, dish receivers.
The receivers, yeah.
Yeah. And now we're kind of going the other direction. And I just don't think this... I'm not likely to buy one. You know, if that's all there were available or the price was negligible, I might get it, but I probably wouldn't use it.
Yeah, that's what I wonder, is that if when the time comes up that I'm ready to buy a new TV and you're ready to buy a new TV, is this going to be all there is to choose from? You know, that's, I'm not looking forward to that because I really don't want this.
Well, but the simple solution is just don't connect it to the Ethernet.
Very true. Don't connect it.
You know, like if you have a video source that you're happy with, you don't need to put RJ45 into it or put it on your local wireless LAN.
And in my living room, that's impossible anyways, because I do not have wired internet going to my living room. Our next article is another piece of hardware that was hacked from Kotaku. I think that's how you pronounce it. A hacker claims to have the PS3's front door keys. And what they mean by that is they've got the signature. So GeoHot, George Hotz, has said that he has found the root key, which means he can write any application that will run on the PS3 architecture, apply this root key to it, and the PS3 will think it is a valid from Sony application and run it. You know, this is how a lot of people do the homebrew stuff to get non-approved applications onto devices. And now they've done it for the PS3. One of the reasons they did this is because PS3 used to let you install other operating systems. So a lot of people installed Gentoo Linux on their PS3. And in a recent update, they removed the other operating system feature, screwing over a lot of their user base. Do you think this is important at all for a gaming console to have the root key be out in the wild?
I mean, I think it's important to Sony because now, you know, people can make counterfeit games. To the average user, I don't know anyone that's like done this to a PlayStation 3. I know a couple people that put like Yellow Dog Linux maybe on their PlayStation 2, I want to say.
Yeah, Yellow Dog is another one that will run on them.
Maybe even their Xbox, I can't remember.
That also works on the PS3 too, yeah.
Okay. So anyway, I mean, I've heard some, but these guys that I know that have done it are like, you know, they're just doing it because they like want to screw
They're
around.
The 1% of the tech sector that,
like,
does this.
I don't know anyone else that's done it. And I just, for me, it's like, if I want a Linux box to play with, I'll just grab some old Windows machine and wipe the hard drive and download Red Hat.
Exactly.
It's like,
I'm not going to brick my $400 PlayStation just to try to put Linux on it.
I don't get it. I don't really get it. I mean, I know it's cool if you're like into that stuff, fine, yay, but
Yeah. That's my same feeling on, you know, mobile phones as well. You have all of the Android people who, oh, look, it runs Linux. I can root it and I can install this stuff and do all this stuff. I just want my phone to work.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same way I feel about my PS3. My PS3 is my Blu-ray player, and eventually when Portal 2 comes out, I will be playing Portal 2. The only other game that PS3 has seen is the original Portal. You know, I just want it to work for what it is. I don't want to mess with it. So yeah, I guess if you're one of the 1% of people who like to do that stuff, then this is a win for you that the root key is out there. But yeah, for me, I couldn't care less. So now we have a few mobile phone, mobile technology stories to take us out. And the first one I thought was really cool from IT World. They talk about, France, you know, not having any parking spaces. Well, it seems that the people of France have been using some services from some companies there and their phones to look up parking spaces. They have sensors in the ground that are able to measure 3,000 sensors buried 9 inches apart to pinpoint open parking spots. They say within 980 feet, which is actually a lot. But if you think about, if you're driving around, you know, a 4-block radius trying to find a spot, and you look at your phone and it says, hey, on the 400 block, there's an open spot, that's good enough for me.
Yeah. Once you can get within, like, you know, be able to see it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what do you think about this? I mean, I think this is awesome.
I do too. I think this is really cool. I think technologies or applications or anything that allows people to spend less time waiting. It's like, you know, I guess another sort of something on the same topic of like waiting is like Disney World. I was there over the holiday and I didn't actually have to wait in too many lines. It wasn't terribly packed. But the one time that we did want to ride, one particular ride, the line was like over 2 hours long.
Wow.
It was like 120 minutes or 120. Well, I guess it's about 2 hours. And we just happened to walk up to the line and this guy stopped us and he's like, hey, are you going to ride this test track ride? And I said, yeah. And he goes, do you want some go to the or fast passes, they call them. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I was always a little skeptical. Like,
is he scalping tickets?
Yeah, am I doing something wrong? I'm like, how much do you want? He's like, no. He's like, here, you take them. And then I looked, and he had a Disney name tag on. And apparently, I guess, like, Disney's, like, staking out, like, people for, like, times when the ride is, like, not used at all and no one's coming to get the fast passes. They, like, have them get a bunch of the fast passes. And then they try to balance out the load by giving people the tickets, like, hey, you can go ride right now and stuff like
okay.
that. And they're also experimenting with, like, using cameras to detect crowd sizes and like make announcements or do something to, like, push people to certain parts of the park that are underutilized
right.
to keep the ride times or the lines down. So this is a similar technology where it reduces your waiting time by doing some work in the background that you otherwise wouldn't have insight into. And I think it's a really cool thing.
Yeah, I definitely do. I wish it would come around here, but, you know, looking to see that they have, you know, over 3,000 sensors under the ground, that means that places around here would also have to do that, and that's got to be pretty expensive.
Yeah, I think the fact that it uses sensors is unfortunate. Like, one thing they could maybe do is, like, start to use, like, municipal cameras. Like, a lot of municipalities have cameras all over the place.
Right.
They could maybe use that technology to detect open spaces. I mean, there's probably other ways to do it, but yeah, it's not. It probably wouldn't be cheap to install.
Yeah, and on the downside, the article also points out that these can be used to detect people parked illegally and quickly, more quicker than before, give you tickets or tow you.
But that's cool too, because I think it's crappy when people, you know, use a service that really is theirs and makes it worse for everybody else.
Right. Yeah. So I wish that would come around here, but France, good job. Our next article is one that I just put in here so that I could poke fun at Android. And it seems that people were mistakenly text messaging the wrong person because of some bad code in Android's default text message app. So most people, you know, would always complain, you know, oh, well, you know, if you download a third-party app from the App Store or from somewhere on the internet, you know, that's your own fault. That was broken. You know, you run that risk whenever you download other apps. But this one was actually a problem with the Google-written text messaging app. Ryan, I know you know some people that have Android phones. Have you heard of anybody running into this?
No, actually, I haven't ever heard anyone tell me that you know, they sent a text message and it went to the wrong person.
Yeah, I know a couple people with Android phones, and I don't know how much they text, so I don't know that this is that big of a deal.
Well, not to interrupt, but I actually went and looked. They have a link to the Google Code website where the bug is listed, and I'm wondering if this is a bit of a hoax.
Really?
Because there's one message. The first indication of it was reported June 28th, and then there's nothing on it again until like January 2nd, and then or somewhere around that time frame, I think.
Well, I'm looking at it right now, and I see that. But what I also see is, yeah, the comments go from June 28th, and they jump to January 2nd. But right above that, it says showing comments 989 to 1488. So it skipped the middle 987 comments.
Okay, so there are some reports afterward. But by and large, the majority of the reports were like in the January time frame. So I think somebody jumped on this and made it worse than it seems, or maybe it's not quite as widespread. There's just a ton of like posts around the January time frame.
Yeah, so it goes from June 28th to July 9th to July 22nd to August to September. And these are all, I'm not like skipping posts. These are one post right after another. So they're all like a month apart.
And then like in December 31st, boom, it
takes off.
Pile on.
And I'm wondering if thousands. This is just like when it hit the message boards that this was happening.
Maybe, but like it just seems to me that it wasn't that big a problem before, or maybe people just didn't notice. I don't know.
That is true. Like, you know, like we both said, we don't know anybody who ran into this problem.
It's like those reports I always used to see about like over 40% of text messages are dropped, which I have a hard time believing because I don't seem to have that many drop. But then again, it's like if you send a message, how many times did you even expect a reply?
Right.
And maybe they just decided, you know, they might even have software that detects the conversation and says, oh, the last response was like, okay, and it just doesn't send it because it's like, I'm not going to waste bandwidth on that. You know, like, you just wonder what's happening behind the scenes. So I guess my point is that you just might not even notice.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have had text messages get dropped. Like, I'm having an important conversation with somebody, a conversation that I probably shouldn't have over text message because, you know, you can't detect voice tone. I'm trying to get across important information, so I should have just called, but I was texting instead. And then I realized...
So you're, like, breaking up with your girlfriend?
I do that all the time over text message. But I realized that this person hasn't answered, and when they do answer, they didn't answer anything that I just asked them. So I'm like, did you not get this? And I forward my message. They're like, no, I didn't get that. That has happened on more than one occasion, and it always happens when I cross carriers. So I don't know whether it's just, you know, AT&T hating Verizon and Verizon hating AT&T, but that seems to be the only time I've ever had a dropped text message is going across carriers.
Yeah, so the thing I always tell people is if you send an invitation or a message via text and you don't get a response, do not feel chagrin until you check with the person if they got the text, because
right.
They may not have.
Right. It is possible. Always send a, hey, did you get this? And not in a mean tone either.
Right. Like, hey, jackass.
You will not make this putt. So the next article is yours.
Yeah. This is on Engadget. There was a story right around, I think it came out like a couple nights before the New Year's Eve holiday, but that the iPhone alarms on New Year's Day weren't going to work. And Apple said, no worries.
Yeah, this has actually happened once before. There was one other time.
Yeah,
when the
daylight savings time thing happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like because the whole change of daylight savings time. And I'm sorry, Kevin's distracting me with his camera.
Sorry, I was taking a picture of the live broadcast.
Oh, okay. So at some point, like, I guess they just found out this was going to happen again, and somebody said, hey, this is going to happen again on January 1st, and they found out why because there's like some bug in the code, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, Apple's like, oh, no worries. On January 3rd, all will be well. It'll all go back to normal. Well, it didn't. And I'm not sure how long it lasted, but several days afterwards, the alarms were still not going off that people had set in their iPhones. Now, these, it was only one specific type of alarm. It was a non-reoccurring alarm.
Yeah, a one-off alarm.
Like a one-off alarm, which most people don't have. Like, if you have an alarm, you set it every day, it probably goes off or whatever. But nonetheless, if you set an alarm for a specific day to get up a different time, it wouldn't go off, and you were late, and it's all Apple's fault. And I think we should not ever buy anything Apple again because of this bug.
And what made me think is that they said, oh, yeah, just wait till the third. Like, yeah, we don't care. We know it's a problem. We're not going to fix it. Just wait a couple days.
We're not going to fix it because it only happened on one day.
Yeah, you don't need to get up on the first or the second.
Yeah. It's like, well, what if I want to set my clock back 5 days and get up again, celebrate the holiday again?
Yeah, so this, unfortunately, I mean, I use my iPhone as an alarm, but unfortunately, I didn't care about getting up on the first or the second, so I didn't have an alarm set, so I didn't notice this. But I really want to see the code that breaks this.
Well, I mean, calendar calculations can be challenging. I mean, it's especially with all this daylight saving crap that keeps changing.
But
you know, like every year it's different.
I just don't understand how it cannot work for these one-off alarms. Like, if it's just, you know, a one-off weekday alarm, the calendar app on the iPhone knows that this day is a Monday and this day is a Saturday. Why does the clock app not know this? You know, like, is the code really that separate?
It's probably a modulus error.
And especially, like, the daylight savings time. Like, I just want to see the code. You know, is there just some piece of code in there that says, if January 1, return true? You know, somebody put in a joke into the code?
Maybe they're actually using the original Pentium chip in there, and it's the Pentium floating point bug that's causing the problem.
There's a Pentium inside of my iPhone? That is awesome.
That makes it way cooler.
That does. But I'll just bring this up now because I don't have any articles listed from CES, but did you see any of the new phones that were put out at CES?
Well, I saw the new Dell Streak, I think. Is that what it's called?
That is one of their phones. I don't know if that was the one that was a CES, though. I'm not sure.
Well, whatever one they said it was going to be sold unlocked in the United States, but it only has 3G for AT&T. So.
Oh, nice.
So basically, you can use it on AT&T, and it's unlocked, and you can try to take it to T-Mobile, but you'll be struck with Edge.
So it's unlocked for any carrier as long as it's AT&T.
Yeah.
Well, there was one phone, the Atrix. I believe Motorola makes it. It actually does have, I think, a dual-core Pentium processor inside of it. It's pretty much a computer.
Wow.
Because they make a laptop, just like, you know, our laptops here, keyboard, screen, with a little dock connector in the back. There's nothing inside of the laptop. No processor, no motherboard, no nothing. The phone is the computer. That's how fast it is.
Wow.
You dock the phone into this keyboard monitor combo that looks like a laptop, and you have a laptop that runs Windows. I might be confusing two devices. I think I am. So, yeah, it runs Android, whatever it's running. Because there was also a mobile phone device that when it was in a dock ran Windows 7, and then when you take it out of the dock, it goes to Android.
That's HP Slate, right? HP Slate?
I don't know.
One of the HP laptops had that where you could like undock the display, and it was like a tablet that ran Android.
That might have been it then, because yeah. It looked like a tablet, yeah.
But actually, it wasn't. I don't know if it was actually Android, but it was some flavor of Linux.
Yeah.
But in any case.
It was cool. And I just thought the Atrix was cool because it is a phone. It's the size of a phone, but it has a dual-core processor, and you can dock it.
It's like, is the battery life terrible?
they did not mention that.
Yeah.
They specifically ignored it.
The battery life is 3 days with the optional external battery pack that you carry around your belt.
Right. You need the backpack version. Speaking of battery life, Kevin Rose broke the story. The article that I have in the show notes is kind of a rumors article, but a couple days ago, Kevin Rose posted on his blog that he has inside sources at Apple that say that the iPad 2 will be coming out within the next 3 to 4 weeks. So I was ready to push the button and buy an iPad yesterday. And by yesterday, I mean like a month ago. Like I want a tablet. I want to use it as my photography portfolio. I want a tablet device. And I was ready to buy an iPad. But then I heard about this and I'm like, oh, iPad 2, Retina display, camera, better battery life. I think I might wait. Are you at all interested in a newer version of the iPad? Are you at all interested in tablets in general?
I am interested in tablets, but The original iPad's lack of a front-facing camera for me was a game ender.
Okay.
It sucked. I wasn't gonna buy it without it.
Deal breaker.
It was a deal breaker. I think that the display. I think the fact that it wasn't a 1080p display was sad.
Yeah, it was 1024 by 768.
Right, so it's like not even 720p quite really.
Well, yeah.
No, because 720p is like 1366 by 768 or something.
720p is 1280 by 720. 768p is 1366 by 768. It's that weird format.
Well, so no, but still, it's short on pixels in the one.
Wide. It's not wide enough. Yeah.
So it's like it's not HD. Okay. But it's still higher res than like VGA. So it's decent. It's just not quite there. And there's some things I could see using a tablet for like browsing the internet, stuff like that. But it doesn't really, I don't have a need for something that isn't a laptop for what I do on a laptop yet.
Right.
That may happen, but I don't. So it would just be a gadget I would buy. And that being said, the other tablets out there, I'm really, really waiting for the Android tablet or even for that market to develop more, but even more so the Playbook, to see what the Playbook's going to do.
Let's skip ahead to that article that we have, since we're talking about tablets now, about the Playbook. This was another one that you submitted. Do you just want to talk a little about the Playbook right now for those people who don't know?
Yeah, sure. So Engadget was at the live at Decol and Dive into Mobile. It's a little bit different. I guess it's a spinoff of like the All Things D conference. So it's like all mobile things. So they had an interview with Mike Lazaridis. How do you say his name?
Lazaridis?
Lazaridis from RIM. And they talked about the Playbook. And really the reason I put this article in here is because I just was like, wow, they dropped the ball in this interview. Like, I mean, they really seemed unprepared to answer the questions that everyone wanted answered about RIM. And they really just had to say, wait for the playbook. Now, the Playbook is pretty cool because it runs a version of QNX, which is a really solid, I think it's a BSD-based OS.
It's a Unix-based.
It's Unix?
So, yeah. It's
okay.
Unix. I don't know if we talked about this or if maybe I talked about this before you came onto the show, but Unix is actually the Unix variant that runs most of the world's power grids.
Yeah.
Like, that's how stable it is.
Oh, yeah. It's like an awesome OS, but I thought it was an offshoot of Linux or BSD, but anyway, it's pretty solid. It's dual processor, I think. I thought it was. And it's pretty advanced. Like, I think it's going to be a pretty advanced tablet, but it seems like they're banking all the future on this QNX or QNX based platform, and they're really leaving the smartphone market to die.
And here's two things I want to say about the Playbook. First one with QNX is that you don't have a developing network anymore. Your BlackBerry applications won't run on it because it's a different operating system.
Well,
you need people to rewrite everything.
BlackBerry uses Java, so I'm pretty sure I think the application platform is pretty much Java. So as long as it has a Java runtime on it, it probably will run some.
Yeah,
apps,
hope.
Or,
yeah.
Or with very little like change to it.
Right. Yeah. So that is a big change that people might not have thought about.
Right.
You know, the huge architecture change.
Yeah.
But the other thing, I've said for a while before, a couple days ago made me change my mind, but for a while I've said, I want the Playbook. Like, my initial thought when I saw the iPad was, I want an iPad, I want it now, I don't want to pay that much, so I didn't buy it. But then I saw things about the Playbook coming out. I saw the videos. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. If it was out today, I will buy it. Like, I had my money ready, I was going to buy the Playbook. But a couple days ago, I went to BlackBerry's website, went to their Playbook page, and I saw something that made me say, BlackBerry, I will never buy a thing from you again. The Playbook is not just a tablet. You can only get it from Sprint, which means you need to buy their data plan, which means another monthly service contract.
Oh.
That is the only way you can get the Playbook, as of now.
Right. Well, is it even released yet?
No, no.
Oh, this is just like pre-release stuff.
Yeah. If you go to their website, you can see it. And only on one of the slides do they have the little Sprint logo that tells you you can only get it from Sprint. So they're trying to hide that from people. But yeah, once I saw that, I'm like, I'm done with the playbook. I'm not even looking at it anymore.
Yeah, well, I'd like to see what happens when they actually release it. But I mean, if that's the case, that's I think that's pretty short-sighted.
Yeah, if they made a Wi-Fi only version, I'll buy it right now.
Yeah.
But if I'm not paying another monthly bill, that's ridiculous.
I still want to see a playbook and hold it. I mean, because I did mess around with an Android tablet. I think it was one of the ones Verizon sells, and it's definitely just not as polished. The OS isn't as polished. The interface isn't as polished as the iPad.
Yeah.
But that said, like, I'd be willing to give up a little bit of the polish for more flexibility. So we'll see. I mean, but in terms of this iPad 2, yeah, I'll take a look at it. But it's probably going to be ridiculously expensive. Even though, yeah, Steve Jobs said this is a breakthrough price. I really just don't think it was. It's like the same price as a phone, but it's bigger, so it makes their job easier.
And it's not a phone.
Right, and it doesn't, yeah, and it's not a phone. You know, so it does all the same things. Because, I mean, face it, an iPad is an iPhone. It doesn't do anything different from an iPhone, except it doesn't make calls.
Same OS, same apps.
Right, and it's bigger. So their job, in terms of engineering it, is easier. Like, yeah, there's more material in it, but they don't have to pay an engineer to shrink everything down to, like, microscopic size.
Right. Yeah, and I think you hit the head on the nail with the lack of the front-facing camera in the first one. You know, what you could see most people using a tablet for is, you know, sitting on their couch, video conferencing with family. But you can't do that with an iPad.
Right.
You know, that's the perfect device to do that with because of the big screen. But I'm interested to see if Kevin Rose is right, if it is going to come out in the next couple weeks. If it comes out at the same price points as the current iPad, I will buy one the day it comes out because I want a tablet device. Like you said, you don't really have a need. You have a laptop that does what you need. I've actually found a need that I could use a tablet for, so now I'm ready to buy one. So I'm interested. But while we're on the iPad iPhone topic, this next article from Computer World is a little concerning, and I believe it applies to more than just the iPhone. So the article is, scammers can hide fake URLs on the iPhone. And I'm sure everybody with an iPhone has seen this. You go to a web page such as any of the Google Docs, and the address bar slides up out from view. It disappears. So the web page appears as if it's a normal full screen application. Well, anybody using, you know, certain tags in your HTML can take advantage of this get rid of the Chrome of the browser feature. So scammers are now using this whenever you visit their page to hide the address bar so you can't immediately see that you're on a malicious page.
Uh-huh.
And they're tricking people into, you know, stealing identities and such. And I don't want to say for sure, but I would think that Android and does BlackBerry do this? Is there a way that, like, the address bar goes away so web page has full view, full screen?
Well, actually, there's, like, really no address bar in the browser. It's kind of like there's a when you fire it up, there's, like, at least on my BlackBerry, I don't know about the touch screen ones, but I have the bold. And there's like a home page where you type the address in, and then it just loads up the page. And then if you want to go to a website, you like hit the menu button and say go to,
okay.
And then it brings up the page again where you type the address in. So yeah, I guess they could. You wouldn't be able to see it.
Right. Yeah. So this does sound like it's more of a problem than just the iPhone, like the article points out. Yeah, that is, it's one of those things that I always say, don't jailbreak your phone. And this is just one more reason not to do that, because when you jailbreak your phone, if you do go to a malicious site, they now have full access to your OS and can backdoor your phone, steal your data. Whereas if you don't jailbreak your phone, stuff is sandboxed properly, you know, protections are in place. So whether it's BlackBerry, Android, or iPhone, you know, if you have an unjailbroken phone, you're probably going to be safe for most things, unless you're just an idiot and you like typing in your sensitive information to any website on the internet. Which I don't do. I know you don't do.
No.
But some people do.
Yeah.
So our last article of the day. This just happened earlier today at 11 a.m. Verizon Wireless had a mystery event. Everybody pretty much knew what it was before it happened. It was Verizon unveiling the iPhone on their own network.
A CDMA version of the iPhone.
So, apparently, let me just say, go on the record to say right now, I was wrong. Everything that I have said about when Verizon will get the iPhone and what it will be on air up until this point was completely wrong. Because I said they would not do what they did today. What they did today is they came out with the iPhone 4, the same iPhone 4 that AT&T users have. The only difference being the different antenna to work on CDMA. I didn't see that coming. I thought that Apple was going to wait until LTE was a little more mature, maybe until the June or July timeframe when they normally release iPhones, and then they would release a true 4G phone for AT&T and Verizon at the same time. But they didn't do that. What do you think about what they did today?
Well, I think it's at different points. I know I probably flip-flopped on my opinion of it, but I know at one point I thought that, you know, maybe they would wait for LTE, or that at least I thought it would have been a really good, you know, footing to come off on. It's like, wow, we've got the best network in the world now. But I also said a couple times I thought they might release a CDMA version, because even when an LTE version of the iPhone comes out, if Verizon is to sell it on their network, even though AT&T will have LTE and they'll have their own, you know, network of LTE towers, the Verizon version will still have to work on its legacy 3G network, which is CDMA. So there's no getting around CDMA in an iPhone at some point.
So kind of like right now with the iPhone on AT&T, when you're in an area without 3G, you drop back to Edge.
Right.
So the same thing would happen with an LTE Verizon phone. When you don't have LTE, you drop back to EVDO.
Exactly. This is the CDMA,
right,
3G technology.
Right.
So yeah, you have to support it so that you have, because AT&T tried this. They released some phones a while back this is a ways back. We're talking like 2002, that used their new GSM network that wouldn't work on their TDMA network. And that was bad because there was very little TDMA or GSM coverage at the time. And it was just bad for everybody. You know, they got these phones, they only worked on one network, and you could get these like dual band phones. Like now we have triple and quad and quintuple band phones, but these were a new concept, these dual band phones. So they were like more expensive, and it just was a bad all around. So you don't want to release a phone that doesn't work on the legacy network. So I think CDMA was unavoidable for Apple if they were ever to release on Verizon in the next, I'd say, 5 to 10 years, you know, depending on when they phase.
Right, because CDMA would always be a failover for the next 5 to 10 years.
Right, until all the markets get upgraded, which could be 10 years, you know, easily.
Yeah, and just like they said during the press conference, you know, this phone, the CDMA iPhone, was in testing for over a year. Mm-hmm. So think about a year ago, LTE wasn't really even thought of yet. As coming out, I mean, it was thought of, but you didn't know when Verizon was going to have it. You didn't know if Verizon was going to have it, or AT&T.
It's basically just a matter of development cycles. They missed the development cycle probably by a couple months. They probably could have done it if it lined up. I think though they might have held the phone a little too long. Like, it just seems to me that I'm just wondering what kind of testing, you know, they really would have needed to do, other than some air handling. For when, you know, you're talking and you can't switch to data and all that jazz.
So you think they should have came out with it like last June or July?
I think they should have been on this a couple years ago. And I really think that...
I agree with you, but at the same time, they couldn't because of the exclusivity agreement that they signed with AT&T, that Apple signed with AT&T.
Yeah, but why? Why would you sign exclusivity agreement? Like, I just don't get it. Like, I know these other manufacturers make phones, and they make, you know, they have an exclusivity agreement. I can't say that word. I have a cold, too, so it's making it harder. But, the, like, you know, the Galaxy S phone, like they have 10 versions of it, and they're all the same damn phone.
Right.
But they're available on all the different networks. Like, really, Apple, like, you really couldn't make it like an Apple V and an Apple A and an Apple whatever.
Well, that is something that Apple doesn't do. If you look at their product lineup, they have the MacBook. They have the Mac Pro. They don't make 30 different devices for all different possibilities. You have one device with a couple features you can change, but they have one device for each thing.
Yeah, but we're only talking, like, they make, like, what, 3 MacBooks and 2 MacBook Airs, or 3 MacBook Pros, a regular MacBook, 2 MacBook Airs, and all their desktop computers. You're telling me they couldn't add, instead of adding one product, they add 3 products to their line? You know, one for the CDMA networks, one for the GSM networks, right, and one for the rest of the world, or whatever. You know, whatever they do,
yeah.
But it's like, I think they really shot themselves in the foot because, CDMA is now in its sunset period. And
right, they're coming out with a phone, and CDMA is, quote-unquote, going away.
Right. And already they're talking about, like AT&T was quoted today saying, like, well, AT&T is bigger than the iPhone. We're more than just the iPhone. We're, a world-class network, and we have lots of devices and blah, 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 blah. And they plan to run advertisements that really hit Verizon hard on the fact that our 3G is, on paper faster than theirs. And even actually, it might even actually be faster now. I believe it is with some of the new HDSPA technologies.
Yeah, AT&T's network is technically faster than Verizon's.
Yeah, I think they have that now.
Yeah.
I mean, at least on 3G. And also, you have the whole dual voice data thing that you can't do.
That is another big point that I wanted to bring up today. And this is one of the reasons why I thought that Steve Jobs would not allow an iPhone to go to Verizon before LTE, because he is a perfectionist. And one of the main points when the iPhone came out, the iPhone with 3G support came out, because the first iPhone did not have this. But when the iPhone came out with 3G support, he pushed. That was his main selling point. You can talk and browse the internet at the same time. And anybody who knows Steve Jobs knows that he does things his way or it's nobody's way. And I really thought that he would not allow Verizon to have an iPhone that couldn't do that. But I was wrong.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think that feature is definitely useful, but it's limited in its use. We're talking, fractions of the time spent on the phone that would be done in this dual mode thing. And it doesn't prevent you from putting the iPhone onto Wi-Fi and using data on Wi-Fi and voice on the phone. That'll still work, just like any smartphone. So I still think that this dual mode use is a limited case. I think if they were really concerned about it, they could have overcome it. And I think the way they could have done that is by putting 2 radio channels in the phone, so that normally it only used one, but if you wanted to use 2, you could link one channel up on 3G for data and the other channel up on, like, voice.
Right.
But that would come at some cost to Verizon, and that they would every iPhone could possibly be using 2 channels. More than likely, it wouldn't use 2. It would just fall back to 1 in normal use.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you. The use is definitely limited. However, I have had those uses come up, more than one time. 2 that I can think of. We were talking about this earlier while we were eating supper. I mentioned that, I've had a family member call me. I had just gotten out of church. I was sitting in a parking lot, and they're on their way to a doctor's appointment in a town that they're not really familiar with, but that's uh-huh. where the doctor is, and some roads were closed, and they had no idea how to get where they were going. So I'm basically on speakerphone with them while I'm using Google Maps to tell them, turn here, turn there, get to where you're going. And the other case, the other case I also used it is I was refinancing my mortgage, and I'm talking to the mortgage person on the phone, and they're saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to email you these documents. Tell me what you think if we're going to do this. Give me the information. So while I'm talking to that person, I'm getting the email from them with the documents, reading it, searching through my email for another document I have with all of my past information, giving them information. So, without being near Wi-Fi, without being at my house, I have access to everything and I can do stuff. So, yes, it is limited. Most people probably have never done those 2 things that I have. But I've had it happen, about 5 times. So that's one reason. That's probably the reason why I will not switch to Verizon and keep my iPhone. yeah. because of that. I've had it happen too many times.
Well, you know, it might be that they that, you know, as our lives become more connected to our phones, that dual voice thing will become, you know, it'll become more of an issue because we'll want to use it more. But I think the issue goes away with LTE. I think LTE supports it. So this is like, it's a short-term issue. And I still think that I don't know. It just seems to me that this is like too little too late. Had they released an LTE phone, I would have been like, wow, big step. Like,
that's what I was expecting.
You know, there's Apple. Cause like we were, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine about the event. He's like, well, maybe they'll have one more thing.
Oh yeah.
You know, at the end of their conferences, they're famous for, oh, and one more thing.
Well, this wasn't an Apple event. This was a Verizon event.
It was. But to me, I think Apple just botched this all the way around. You know, just they, I mean, I know Verizon initially turned them down, but they, and I'm not sure why they did initially. I'm not sure, but I think it was probably because of the rules that Apple wanted.
Well, to go along with that, sorry to cut you off, but to go along with that, you know, Apple doesn't allow bloatware on their iPhone. You know, like any other phone you get on any other carrier, you get default Verizon apps or default Sprint apps. You don't get that on the iPhone. But I have been hearing reports that the Verizon iPhone will come with Verizon bloatware.
Oh, I thought I read that it wasn't, but that you'd still be able to download like the VCast app and stuff if they.
I've heard both that you can. Yeah. They'll find a way to download it, or they'll just include it in the base ROM image because they can't put it in the store because not everybody could get it. Unless you're Verizon, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So, but yeah, that's probably one of the things that Steve said, no, I'm not allowing you to put your apps on it.
Well, that is a weird problem for Apple now. If there wants to be a network-centric app, like what about like Verizon billing?
Right. Yeah,
can you do AT&T billing? Do you have an AT&T billing app for the iPhone?
Got an app.
But that presents a problem. Not just because it's Verizon, but because they've split between two networks now. They're going to have to make a rule that you're allowed to put an app on there that only works on one of the networks.
And, I mean, my AT&T one does. So I guess it's already there in the fact that it's an app made by AT&T for an AT&T service contract that's in the App Store. So maybe they will allow that with Verizon's apps.
Yeah, they must. I mean, there's really no way around that.
Yeah.
You know, Verizon-centric apps. But I don't know. I just think it's like a little, it's too little, too late. I mean, maybe in the end it'll play off for them because, you know, they will have worked out all the bugs on the one network and now they just add the second network and where Android had to like start out with all these different networks. And
yeah, personally, I think they blew it. I think coming out with this specific, you know, just a CDMA iPhone 4 was not the right thing to do. You know, like you, I wish they would have waited or come out with an LTE phone. But
I still think they're going to sell a lot of these things.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, Kevin Rose, I actually left it on my phone so that I could reference it. He tweeted out a poll asking, you know, of you iPhone users, are you going to switch? And here are the numbers for the poll out of a lot of people who voted. 318 people said they will switch from AT&T. 170 said they're going to Verizon because it's their first iPhone. Over 1,000 said, nope, sticking with AT&T. And 279 said, I don't have an iPhone, I don't care.
Right.
But the big number was 59% of the users who responded to his poll said they're sticking with AT&T. And personally, that's what I'm going to do because I have a feeling that, you know, that you're right, that they are going to sell a lot of them, and Verizon's network is going to get pounded with iPhone users. And I'm willing to bet that in the next 2 months, we see Verizon's network take a hit similar to the way AT&T's did when they first got the iPhone. They just couldn't handle it.
Well, there's one thing I do disagree in, because the only way this would happen, like it did with AT&T, is if Verizon's subscription rates go way up. Which would be unprecedented in the industry.
And that, sorry to interrupt, but they didn't mention that. You know, nobody knows the pricing yet. They didn't say that in the press release.
Oh, right.
It's to be announced.
Yeah, there's no pricing yet. But like for their subs, no, I meant not their rates. I meant like the number of people joining onto the network.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Or that an unprecedented number of people drop their feature phones for iPhones. or for a smartphone.
And we could
at
possibly
all.
See that happen.
That could, but if you look at this, if you look at the subscription rates for Android and like you know and all that sort of thing, they're not behind the curve of other providers in terms of smartphones to feature phone ratio. Okay. So we'd have to see an unprecedented number of people switch over and that there would be a ton of pent-up demand on Verizon's network. There might be some pent-up demand.
Right.
But I don't think it's going to be in the, you know, tens of percents. It's going to be in, like, the 5% range or less, like 1%.
See, I'm going to say that maybe overall you're right, but I'm going to say in New York and San Francisco we're going to see upwards of 30% increase. Because maybe, everybody will be switching.
Maybe in certain areas you might be right. But I would venture most people that go for an iPhone on Verizon will be dropping an existing smartphone. And most of the data out there says that the Android and BlackBerry smartphones use more data per app than the iPhone. So if they can already handle those subscribers with an Android phone, they should be able to handle them with an iPhone
right.
too.
You think? Yeah, phones shouldn't matter. They
right.
should be able.
Well, but I guess they're just saying is that like Android is a little top heavy on the network side. It tends to use more data,
right?
Because of the network topology on it or whatever.
Yeah, that's interesting to see how the next or not the next 2 months, but February 10th is when Verizon iPhone goes live. You can pre-order it the week before. But it'll be interesting to see starting February 10th for the next month or two, you know, how the network usage plays out and how Verizon handles it. If there's any change at all, you know, maybe like you said, they can already handle it because of Android. They've had smartphones for a while. So I'm interested to see what happens. So that is it for this week's episode of the Sloncast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Sloncack. You can find Ryan on Facebook and Twitter. His username is Ryan Lancey. If you would like us to talk about something on the show, just bookmark that webpage on Delicious. And for next week's episode, give it the tag Sloncast020. Next week will be episode 20. And again, from our first episode of 2011 and our first episode with snow, everybody have a wonderful, wonderful evening.